Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Gideon Long, and on this edition, Australia passes a right to disconnect law, giving people the green light to ignore work emails and phone calls when they're on their days off.
It's really hard to switch off as it is, so having these laws come into place is really important.
Because I'm not engaging necessarily with my boss, I'm also with clients and whatnot, there's more of an expectation that I'm on the line after hours.
We look at the oil tanker that's on fire in the Red Sea 5 days after it was attacked by Houthi fighters. And we ask how the world should deal with ageing populations. That's all to come, but let's start in France, where in the last few moments, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, has insisted that the arrest of Pavel Durov, the Russian-born billionaire founder and CEO of the messaging and social media platform Telegram, was not politically motivated. A police spokesperson said his arrest in Paris on Saturday night is over failing to cooperate over cyber crimes and financial crimes on Telegram. His arrest has drawn criticism from various quarters, including Telegram itself. The owner of X, Elon Musk, said it showed that free speech in Europe was under attack, while Russian Member of Parliament Maria Butina said it was proof of European Union hypocrisy.
The arrest of Pavel Durov means that there is no freedom of speech, that the freedom of speech in Europe is dead. Elon Musk is free, Mark Zuckerberg is free, but Pavel Durov is now in prison. Why? Because he's Russian. He's a Russian by nationality and he's Russian by his citizenship. So he has been traced as a person to be a scapegoat for the West as an evil Russian.
So an evil Russian or a champion of free speech? Who is Pavel Durov and what is Telegram? My colleague Stefania Gotze explains.
Pavel Durov has found himself on the wrong side of both the Kremlin and the European Union during his short but eventful career as a tech entrepreneur. Still only 39, he co-founded Russia's most popular social media network, VKontakte, or VK, in 2006. He then founded Telegram in 2013 as an alternative to the big US tech platforms like WhatsApp and Instagram. But just a year later, Durov was forced to flee Russia after he refused to share the data of some of his users with Russia's security agency. He settled in Dubai and has dual French and United Arab Emirates citizenship. In 2018, he again denied Moscow access to user data, prompting the Russians to ban Telegram for the next 2 years. That earned him some admirers in the West, but others still accuse him of having close ties to the Kremlin and also say Telegram is so unregulated that it's become a hotbed for organized crime. In May, the EU tech regulators said they were talking to Telegram about its content. According to Forbes, Durov has a fortune of over $15 billion. Durov says Telegram has around 900 million monthly active users and is likely to pass the 1 billion mark within a year.
So that's Pavel Durov and his company. But how safe is Telegram? Is Telegram as a platform? I've been speaking to Alexandra Uhrmann, a researcher at the University of Zurich, who's investigated extreme messaging on Telegram.
My work has been on the specifically far-right extremism on the platform, and we were looking at how the deplatforming of far-right actors and extremist actors on other platforms, let's say on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, how that has affected their behavior on Telegram and how they have moved from more mainstream platforms, so to say, like Facebook or Twitter, to Telegram. And what we saw is in 2019, there was a big wave of deplatforming done by Twitter and Facebook. And then going forward, especially during the COVID pandemic, during the beginning of it, the number of users following and engaging with the content of far-right groups and channels basically skyrocketed. Donald Trump was deplatformed, and even though Trump never actually joined Telegram, when that happened, there was a massive influx of users to Telegram, and a lot of people were actually anticipating Trump joining the platform. So there were a lot of, so to say, grifters creating fake Donald Trump channels that would get like hundreds of thousands of subscribers really quickly. So users following this far-right public figures who were blocked on other platforms to Telegram.
And is this because Telegram is less well regulated than other social media platforms?
Exactly, that's the case. So Telegram is known for its very lax content moderation. They explicitly say in their description of their policies that they do moderate terrorist content, but that if, for example, criticizing the government is illegal in some country, they're not going to be part of what they call politically motivated censorship. And it seems that blocking some of these far-right accounts also goes into the direction of politically motivated censorship on Telegram.
And Telegram does seem to be particularly popular in places where people can and are persecuted for their political beliefs.
Yeah, that is right. Telegram is very popular in authoritarian regimes such as Russia, such as Iran, such as Hong Kong. And it was part of the, for example, protest coordination in Hong Kong in 2019. So it's very popular with people who generally are afraid of being persecuted by the government.
And can you explain for our listeners how Telegram differs from other platforms like WhatsApp? Because it has this reputation as being a platform for people who want to keep their secrecy. But then all social media platforms say that, don't they? They all say that they encrypt messages and they protect the anonymity of their users.
Telegram, from the start, has combined the features of the messenger, people texting each other, and elements of a social media platform, because Telegram has so-called channels, which are very similar to, let's say, Facebook pages. And it also has these very large super groups. Regarding Telegram's security, so as you're saying, it's really known for that. But in fact, most communication on the platform is not end-to-end encrypted, unlike on actually WhatsApp or Signal. So security experts have always been saying that it is actually less secure than what it might seem to be, or the image that it promotes. Pavel Durov himself and the platform itself, they positioned themselves as defenders of free speech, because the platform was created in 2013 amid Pavel's own troubles with the Russian state. So since then, he has been publicly promoting this idea that he's freedom of speech and privacy fighter, and that he will never hand over any data to any government. And they claim that they so far have given zero data to governments, which again makes the platform super attractive to people who are afraid of the persecution by the government.
Alexandra Ehrmann from the University of Zurich there. Now to the Middle East, because an oil tanker is still on fire in the Red Sea 5 days after it was attacked by Houthi fighters from Yemen. Photographs released of the ship, a Greek-flagged vessel called Sunion, show fire and smoke coming out of the vessel's main deck, although there have been no obvious signs of an oil spill. Since late last year, the Iranian-backed Houthis have been attacking ships in solidarity with Palestinians in the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. David Osler is a marine insurance editor of Lloyd's List and joins us now. David, thanks for being on the programme. Dozens of attacks since the start, since all this started at the end of last year, but few as destructive as this one.
No, so far the shipping industry and marine insurers have gotten off remarkably lightly. In fact, there have only been two actual total losses of ships to date, and so far, it's been rather profitable business for Lloyd's in the marine market. But if the worst comes to the worst on this one, it's going to be one hell of a hit.
And do you get the impression that these attacks are picking up? I was reading that back in June, we saw 16 attacks, which I think is the worst month this year so far. Is there any sense that things are getting better, getting worse?
Well, the issue here is what sort of weapons the Houthis have got access to and whether they're getting access to better kit. If they are getting supplied with better equipment, then these attacks tend to get a lot more deadly.
And if this ship is a total write-off, what will that mean for insurance prices and for the insurance market?
It's going to mean a big hike in rates for vessels travelling through the Red Sea. I mean, these insurance policies are priced on a fraction of the ship's value. Currently, on average, about 0.7%. But when people get back to their desks tomorrow and assess this situation, if this turns out as bad as feared, I can only see that going up.
So, yeah, we should probably say it's a market holiday here in the UK. So from what you're saying, we won't really know the true impact of this until tomorrow. But we have known about this attack last week. So was there any impact on the insurance market last week?
The fires on the vessel were only set ablaze on Friday evening, so people haven't had a chance to respond to it as yet. I mean, the initial reaction was that this was a fairly standard marine loss, a standard claim that would be well within the capacity of the market to handle. A total loss is going to be a big bill, and an oil spill cleanup, if it does come to that, of course, is going to be off the charts.
And just more generally, these attacks have now been going on for about 10 months. What has that meant for insurance costs generally for ships? How much more expensive is it to insure a ship that's going through the Red Sea now than it was before these attacks started back in November last year?
Before the attacks by the Houthis started, I mean, the nominal rate was 0.1%, and quite often underwriters would waive that entirely for regular customers. They've now gone up. They have been higher earlier in the conflict. They topped 1%. They've fallen back as people have come to terms with it. As we'll find out in the rest of this week, we'll see how the market reacts. It's a very quick market. It typically reacts to these sorts of developments within hours, so we'll know soon enough.
And this was a Greek flagship. It was sailing from Iraq to a port near Athens, so it doesn't seem as though it was going to Israel. It's not an Israeli-owned ship, but that doesn't seem to offer any kind of protection, does it?
No, it is known that the Houthis are deliberately targeting vessels that they perceive as having tied with Israel. And they have mentioned that they think this vessel has called in Israeli ports. We won't know that for sure till I get access to the tracking data tomorrow, but that might be why they've picked it out. I mean, it is difficult for Israeli-linked vessels even to get cover, of course, because right, some underwriters won't touch that business. It's just seen as too risky.
Mm-hmm. David Osler from Lloyd's List, Marine Insurance Editor at Lloyd's List, thanks for joining us here.
Thank you.
Now I'm with Alex Stewart, Senior Fixed Income Fund Manager at Schroders. And let's stay in the Middle East, Alex, because there's been a bit of a spike in the oil price. Brent crude by as much as 2% today, trading around $79. And I guess that's all to do with geopolitical tensions.
Yes, I mean, it's a combination, I think, of escalation in the conflict between Israel and what's going on there, and Libya, which are actually, they're having a bit of a spat over the central bank and reserves, and they've put a bit of a pause on the exports that are coming from there, and that seems to have been the effect on the oil price today.
And coming to Europe now, Germany's IFO Business Sentiment Index was out today, and it showed that business morale has fallen for a third consecutive month in August. We were talking about Germany last week because they had very poor PMI data, purchasing managing index data, a contraction in the economy in the second quarter. It really does look like Germany might slip into recession now, doesn't it?
I mean, things are, you know, there was a little bit of respite. We saw a little bit of a pickup in the sort of global manufacturing cycle, but that seems to have gone back into reverse again. And that is, you know, what's affecting the German economy most. They seem to have fallen behind a bit in terms of the sort of EV production. And obviously, auto production has been a big part for them. So, yeah, it's not looking very rosy there at the moment.
And looking ahead to later in the weeks, Alex, we're coming towards the end of the earnings season, but one big one on the horizon, chip designer NVIDIA, results scheduled on Wednesday. What are you expecting there?
Well, it's going to be quite interesting because obviously the valuations have absolutely rocketed on the company because of the AI chips that they're doing. So I think the market's going to be looking to see. There's been a bit of a delay in their latest chip, but I think that's largely what people are going to be looking at to see what's happening there, because that wasn't actually expected to come into production till towards the end of the year. But obviously, it's quite a big revenue driver for them.
Alex Stewart from Schroders, thanks for joining us here.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
On World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, is your boss texting you at the weekend? Or are you getting work emails long after you've left the office? Well, now people in Australia can now ignore those notifications. The right to disconnect law, which has just come into force, means that in most cases, employees can't be punished for refusing to respond to their employers outside working hours. Rachel Abdelnour, who works in the advertising industry in Australia, welcomed the changes.
We spend so much of our time connected to our phones, connected to our emails all day. And I think that it's really hard to switch off as it is. So having these laws come into place where we really do disconnect is really important, especially like in my life where I have external clients who need to get a hold of me. We don't always have the same working hours.
Well, one place that a law like this is already in effect is Ireland, which brought it in back in 2021. I asked Laura Bambrick, Social Policy and Legislative Officer at the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, how their law works.
What we have is a code of practice, and the code of practice has three parts. It says that you have the right not to be contacted regularly by your employer. The second part is you have the right not to be the protection, not to be penalised if you ignore those regular contacts. And the third part that often gets overlooked is that we have a responsibility to respect other people's right to disconnect.
And this came in 2021 in Ireland. That was during the pandemic, of course, when we were all flexible working. Was that part of the reason for introducing this code of conduct?
Yeah, so there was a push from our financial services unions from about 2019 to bring in a right to disconnect. But it was really when we all started having to work from our kitchen tables and our spare bedrooms that the idea that a right to disconnect for the first time, a lot of people had a work phone, never had a work phone before or had the laptop and were certainly signing up to more instant messenger apps. So it really catapulted up the political agenda, but also the news agenda and talking about work-life balance.
And so 3 years on, how well, in your view, has this worked?
Well, it's been a mixed bag. So if we look at it about how many employees have actually brought a case to our workplace relations committee or how often it has arisen in workplace relation inspectors, we see that there have been no cases of it. So that might lead you to think two things. It's been a massive success that we're all having our right to disconnect being respected, or it's been a massive flop that it's not worth the paper that it's written on. But if we look at it another way, and that the real success of this has been a real cultural change, there's much more public awareness around our rights as workers to have that right to disconnect from work.
And have you heard any complaints from businesses in Ireland, Laura? I'm just imagining irate CEOs complaining they can't get hold of their employees at weekends or evenings. So what's business had to say about it?
Yeah, so when we were discussing around having this code of practice, there was pushback from business, and we were told three things. One, that it would frighten the Americans, it would frighten inward investment. Two, that we already had this right. So we already had legislation that gave workers rights to have breaks and rest periods. And three, that employees really enjoy flexible working. And so this would prevent employees having flexible working. None of those things happen. There's still massive inward investment from America. And in fact, California is in the process of introducing something similar around a code of practice. Working flexible doesn't mean that you have to sign yourself over to be available 24 hours, 7 days a week. And the idea that we already had, you know, workplace law in place around when we'd have our minimum rest periods and maximum working hours, they have been in place, but some of them are 30, 40 years old, and they predated when we had the smartphone, when we all had a laptop. What we have to remember is rest time and disconnecting is a health and safety issue, and a tired worker is a danger to themselves and others. So we've all got a vested interest in ensuring we have that right to disconnect.
And finally, Laura, since this code of conduct came in, have you changed your own behaviour? Are you less likely to answer your phone these days, less likely to answer emails?
I'm probably better at not ringing and emailing other people, but am I less likely to pick up the phone? No, but I'm more aware that I'm doing it when I'm doing it.
Laura Bambrick there from the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. Now, falling birth rates are a concern around the world, and they can have a massive impact on a country's economy. This has long been the case in Europe and North America, and now increasingly in developing countries like India. With people living longer, there are more elderly, retired people who need looking after and who aren't necessarily contributing to the economy, and fewer younger workers to power the economy. It's a huge issue. So all this week on World Business Report, we're exploring the fiscal challenges societies face due to an increasingly aging population.
It is me who grew these crops and I tend to them. I try and motivate myself to carry out the work that is needed here on the farm, but because I'm on my own, it is difficult.
68 next month.
And you, Ali?
I will be 65 in about 4 weeks. Part of the success of a factory would be having a good age range mix. And I think you need that mix. We can pass on the skills to the younger generation.
I mean, naturally, people want to retire at early age and enjoy their life. But from economics perspective, it's not sustainable. And that is going to become a very heavy burden for the government.
Who is going to employ you? Nobody. They're looking for young guys, young people, youngsters and all this.
And as this batch of seniors dances to Bollywood hits at the end of their tour, can India keep pace with the needs of its ageing population?
A snapshot there of some of our reports this week. You heard there from here in the UK and from India, the world's most populous country, where businesses are trying to benefit from more people being retired. I'm joined by Dr. Paul Morland, demographer and author. Hi, Paul. Welcome to World Business Report.
Hello.
You've recently released a book entitled No One Left, Why the World Needs More Children. Spell it out for us. Why do we need more children?
Well, there are lots of reasons to have children, and I think it's a wonderful, miraculous thing. But if you actually come onto the things that you can measure and manage, the quantitative things, what we see is with fewer and fewer children, 20 years later, you're getting fewer and fewer workers. You have a large cohort retiring in many countries. Today, that's really an issue for the developed world, increasingly for the less developed world, even countries like China, has a diminishing workforce. With a diminishing workforce, you have a drag on the economy. You have a lot of pressure on government spend on health and pensions. You have a declining base of tax revenues and a declining base of innovation. So in every kind of way, if you're not having children today, you're going to have problems in your workforce in 20 and 30 years' time.
So that's the argument for having more children. But surely we can't just keep on increasing the population of the world. The population has already shot up hugely over the last 100 years or so. And this is a world in which we have scarce mineral resources. I mean, is it feasible to just keep producing more children?
When there were about a billion of us back in around 1800, the vast majority of our ancestors back then were extremely poor, had very little access to materials, to food, to education. At 8 billion, we are fantastically better off than we were at 1 billion, 2 billion, and 4 billion. Now, I'm not saying this can go on forever. And eventually, in the long term, technology may come to our aid. But I'm skeptical that AI is really going to substitute labor. We're not seeing it yet again. We're not seeing it in the productivity figures. Like all the last generations of technology, we still need lots of workers. And I think there's still plenty of room for more people with technology, with innovation, with a young, creative population coming up with new ideas, both to live well, have an expanding population, and give more space back to nature and use our resources more efficiently.
People are living far longer than they were, but actually the retirement ages haven't really changed very much. Shouldn't we just be encouraging people to work for longer?
We should be, but first of all, that can only work so far. So Japan in the 60s had about seven or eight people of working age to every retiree. Today, it's two heading to one working age person for each retiree. Moving the pension age a few years is not going to make that much difference when you've got that massive demographic shift going on underneath. And also, whilst I agree it is a good idea, the fact is it meets huge resistance from the population. It costs a lot of political capital. Both Macron and Putin have actually had to retreat on pension reform. It's something people really get fixed in their mind when they want to retire. And just moving it a couple of years, whilst it has a limited beneficial effect, is usually a bit of an electoral disaster.
And how about migration? Could that be an answer? If you need more young people in your workforce, you import them.
Well, one of the chapters in my book argues that that's not the solution, and there are a whole set of reasons, or it's not the full solution. Number one, more and more countries are having fewer children. Ireland, Poland, countries we recruited immigrants for the UK, they're simply having fewer and fewer children. The economic gap is narrowing. It can't be a solution for a country like China, which is far too big to absorb that many immigrants. There just aren't enough people. More and more countries are not producing the children, so it's moving people around. It's not really resolving the issue. And finally, the fact is that if in Ghana, for example, huge investment goes into a child, educating that child, getting that child to be a health professional, is it right that Britain, which has much better health facilities, should be hoovering up the best and the brightest because we think we're too important and too busy to have our own children?
Paul Morland, demographer and author, thank you very much for joining us on World Business Report. And
you can
hear that series. We'll be running it all this week on the programme over the next 4 days, as I say, from the UK, from India, from Kenya and elsewhere. We'll be looking at the impact of demography on the economy.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.